This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
That's one of the key actors that are trying to bring together coalition to try to have some sort of ceasefire for no other reason, for humanitarian aid efforts to get in.
That's Dr. Nola Haynes, political scientist at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service, on the Sudan peace talks going on in Saudi Arabia. Details coming up. Also, a journalist was shot dead on Cameroon, the third journalist to be killed this year. And Arab League foreign ministers have agreed to restore Syria's suspended membership. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. The two warring factions fighting for control of Sudan are holding face-to-face talks in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, for the first time since the fighting began on April 15th. Sporadic fighting is still being heard in parts of the country despite several ceasefires announced earlier. Hundreds of civilians have been killed since the army led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and the rapid support forces commanded by General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo took up arms against each other. Dr. Nola Haynes is a political scientist at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and a senior fellow at the Center for New American Security. Dr. Haynes tells VOA's Carol Van Damme the United States is involved in the diplomacy behind the scenes at the talks in Jeddah.
That's one of the key actors that are trying to bring together coalition to try to have some sort of ceasefire for no other reason, for humanitarian aid efforts to get in. That's one of the largest problems right now, is because of the constant fighting, humanitarian aid has not been able to get into the country to help the insecure. And because of it, migration has been happening from Sudan, from South Sudanese people who did not think they would ever return back to South Sudan since the civil war in 2013, but they're there back again. People are fleeing to Egypt. People are fleeing across the Middle East and Northern Africa.
What's it going to take for these two generals to say, you know, it doesn't have to be a fight to the finish of who's going to come out on top? I mean, is that possible? And could there be some kind of mediated outcome where the RSF is reintegrated somehow into the Sudanese army at this point?
That's a great question. And I wish I had a crystal ball to answer that question. But one of the problems here is you have Western powers who are backing civilian-led government. Then you have other countries. Egypt is supporting the Sudan armed forces. You have the UAE that favors the autonomous RSF that's fighting against the Sudan armed forces. So you have all of these different countries that have different interests that are also playing a part here. So it's going to be very interesting to see what the outcome will be, who will lead Sudan, but that's the issue right now. And so once these things can be hammered out, then we can have a better picture of what it's going to look like going forward. But from what I understand, this is going to be some sort of protracted war. I wish that it wouldn't be. I wish that a diplomatic resolution can be reached soon, because as we all know, with situations like this, you have a situation where you have women and girls being displaced all across North Africa and the Middle East. You have men still there that are fighting. And so you have families that are being torn apart, communities that are being torn apart. And I mean, literally, one of the issues that I'm keeping my eye on is the fact that explosive weapons, have wide ranging effects on the population, that infrastructure, that civilians are being wounded from tanks, artillery, rockets, and air-delivered munitions. And like I mentioned earlier, these are direct violations of laws of war, because you cannot bomb civilian populations.
Right, so but they're doing it anyway. I mean, they're not.
Exactly. So if you're still there in Sudan, there are a lot of insecurities that are happening on top of the violence. And then if you're outside of Sudan, then you are dealing with displacement, hunger, dehydration, mothers trying to care for their children without the correct amount of medicine or being in their own homes. So it's definitely a layered situation. And like I said, my hope is that diplomacy will win the day. I know that it will, but I hope that it will win the day soon.
That's Dr. Nola Haynes, political scientist at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. She was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Damme. The United Nations says Sudan and neighboring nations face a growing humanitarian crisis as hundreds of thousands of Sudanese have fled the fighting. You can find more on the conflict on voaafrica.com. Gunmen have shot dead a journalist in the capital of Cameroon's restive northwest region, Bamenda, the third journalist to be killed in the country this year. Colleagues and family of Andy Nde Nso, bureau chief for a weekly newspaper, The Advocate, says he was killed at a bar in what they believe was a targeted killing. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Cameroon journalist says scores of civilians and reporters on Monday visited the Bamenda residence of reporter Anyen Denso to sympathize with his family. Nso was killed in Bamenda, capital of Cameroon's northwest region, on Sunday night. Jude Muma, local president of the Cameroon Association of English-Speaking Journalists, CAMASEJ, says he led a delegation of several dozen reporters that visited Nso's family. He spoke via telephone from Bamenda.
I speak to you from the family compound, and the family in great pain. Anyende Nso's baby, the mother of the baby, is uncontrollable. Anyende Nso's family is in pain. Neighbors are in pain. Colleagues of the journalism profession are also here in pain that Anyende Nso is no more.
Cameroon media reports that scores of civilians in the southwest region also visited the head office of the Advocate newspaper to sympathize with colleagues of the killed reporter. The newspaper's publisher, Taya Enobika Tabe, says Nso was professionally upright and good-humored, and says he cannot understand why someone would kill him. Taya says he had a long telephone conversation with Nso just hours before the reporter was killed.
2 hours after, I edited his stories, finished talking to him. I had a call that he was shot. This guy was an aspiring young journalist, full of the spirit to work and to serve. A very humble young man is gone. It's a big loss to the Cameroon press. I use this possibility again to condemn the killings of journalists. In fact, they are soft targets. So sad.
Charles Embola, publisher of Volcanic Times newspaper, says his organization is investigating Nso's death and has spoken with several witnesses and officials in Bamenda.
From every indication, it was more of a targeted killing because the guys came in on a bike and went straight and shot him on the chest, and our colleague died on the spot. No other person in that public space was a target.
It was not clear whether the killing was related to the ongoing battle between Cameroon government troops and separatists in the northwest and southwest regions. Separatist forces are trying to split off the regions where most people speak English as an independent state from French-speaking majority Cameroon. The International Crisis Group reports that 6,000 people have been killed since 2017. So far, no one has claimed responsibility for the death of Nso. Cameroon's military says Nso was killed by separatist fighters, but gives no possible motives. Separatists on social media denied involvement in his killing, while a separatist leader, Capo Daniel, said Nso was the victim of a case of mistaken identity. Nso is the third journalist to be killed in Cameroon in 2023. Earlier this year, investigative journalist Martinez Zogu and radio presenter Jean-Jacques Olabebe were killed in the capital Yaoundé. Cameroonian journalists say they remain fearful and have reported killings and threats on journalists to the police. Speaking during World Press Freedom Day activities in Yaoundé, Cameroon's communication minister René Emmanuel Sadi assured reporters of government protection in the exercise of their duties. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Arab League foreign ministers have agreed to restore Syria's membership after a suspension of over 10 years due to the country's civil war. Meeting in Cairo yesterday, the ministers also agreed to support the U.S.-Saudi peace initiative to resolve the conflict in Sudan. Edward Iranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
The Arab League foreign ministers' decision to restore Syria's membership in the body was reportedly not unanimous, but was made in a majority vote taken during a closed session. The move comes days before a scheduled Arab League summit in the Saudi capital, Riyadh. An Arab League statement noted that the resolution of the Syria conflict is a step-by-step matter and that the first step was the resumption of Syrian participation in Arab League meetings. The group supports the territorial integrity of Syria and the withdrawal of all foreign forces from the country. Arab League spokesman Jamal Rushdie said Sunday's decision does not signal an end to the conflict in Syria, but the beginning of an end. He added that the Syria crisis is not just a domestic conflict, but a regional and international conflict, noting that the Arab League would like to be involved in the resolution of the conflict because of its repercussions on many Arab countries. He said the decision to give Syria its seat back is mostly a symbolic political move after so many years of not allowing Syria to participate in the group, and Arab states would like Syria to be a party to the resolution of its conflict. Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA that welcoming Syria back to the Arab League comes at a bad time, several days after the visit of Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi to Damascus, in which Tehran and Damascus concluded long-term deals over oil, phosphates, transport, electricity, agriculture, and other major economic issues.
Le contour de cette résolution.
He says that the decision to give Syria its seat back at the Arab League signals a complete victory of the Syrian regime, and it is symbolic for the Syrian government. The international community, he points out, has allowed Syria to retain its seat at the UN, so if Damascus can still be a member of the UN, there's no reason why it can't be a member of the Arab League. Abu Diab added that Syria is now effectively divided into three or four zones of influence, with the Assad regime controlling a large chunk of the country under Iranian and Russian influence, with the Turks controlling part of the northwest of the country under the control of pro-Turkish militias and jihadis, and with the Kurds controlling the northeast with the support of the U.S., in addition to Israeli control over the skies of the country. On another topic, Arab League head Ahmed Abul Ghait, addressing Arab League foreign ministers, noted that the Sudan conflict is at a crossroads as the situation continues to worsen. He says that many Sudanese refugees are flowing into neighboring countries, and none of seven truces have succeeded in bringing a halt to the conflict, and the Arab League must support the U.S.-Saudi peace initiative to end the conflict amid efforts by various players to divide Sudan into warring mini-states. Saudi-sponsored talks to end the Sudanese conflict are continuing in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, as representatives of both Sudanese military leader General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and the Rapid Support Forces commander Mohamed Hamdan Daglu meet to discuss the situation. Both leaders fought in Yemen under the auspices of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Last week, we brought you a report on how South Africa's government is looking at ways to make it possible for Russian President Vladimir Putin to attend a summit in Cape Town in August. The International Criminal Court has issued an arrest warrant for him for alleged war crimes in Ukraine, and technically, South Africa is obligated to arrest him. In our report, one source gave incorrect information. We regret that mistake, and here's an updated report by Darren Taylor.
Senior member of President Cyril Ramaphosa's cabinet, Obed Bapela, says it's not in South Africa's best interests to arrest the leader of a member of the BRICS grouping. He notes a warning from Russia's former president, Dmitry Medvedev.
South Africa will never arrest Putin. It's a declaration of war, as already Dmitry Medvedev said, that any country that arrests Putin, we are declaring war on us. And it's like when you say you go and arrest the president of U.S., no one will arrest the president of U.S. Nowhere in the world will they ever be arrested.
The BRICS group, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, holds its annual summit in August in Cape Town, which is in the Western Cape. That's the only province in South Africa not governed by the ANC. Western Cape Premier Alan Windey, who's a member of chief opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, said last week he had a warning for Putin and the ANC, led by President Cyril Ramaphosa.
I see the president and the ANC are flip-flopping all over the place. Now they're going to support him, then they're not going to support him, then they're going to be part of the ICC, then they're not part of the ICC. There's no flip-flopping here in the Western Cape. If Vladimir Putin comes here, our law enforcement officers will arrest him and send him to the courts.
But legal expert Mpumulelo Zikalala says that's not likely to happen, as provincial premiers don't control the police.
You can't say as a premier, this is what I'm going to instruct, because they do not get instructions from you. They get the instructions from the commissioner and not you as a premier. You can't effect an arrest warrant as a premier or instruct someone to go and effect it, because you simply have no powers in doing so. You are political head of a particular province, and that's where it starts and that's where it ends.
Several government officials have told VOA that South Africa's ICC laws will be amended. But, says Zikalala, such changes would be subject to parliamentary approval. With the ANC's majority in parliament, there's no doubt they'd become law, but not before likely objections from opposition parties, which would delay the process. So the government remains concerned the law won't be changed in time for the BRICS summit. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
In a speech he gave, Tunisian President Kais Saied rejected the conditions that come with a potential loan from the International Monetary Fund, IMF, calling them dictates. When asked what the alternative is, he responded, "to rely on ourselves." Reactions to the speech, as well as action taken by Tunisian officials before and after that, seem to contradict its intention and causing confusion. Is there a deal or not? Sarah Yerkes, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Middle East Program, discussed these contradicting positions with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
I think Saeed's position is not that surprising. He has long rejected what he calls foreign interference in Tunisia's affairs, and he really has never been fully on board with the types of reforms that the IMF is requesting that Tunisia undertake. But his position is also not clear at all. He has not clarified how the Tunisian government can possibly find the funds at home to address the massive economic crisis facing Tunisia.
European governments, especially that of Italy, which has been lobbying for IMF with increasing anti-migrant policy, and lately the European Union and the US, whose respective top diplomat publicly urged Tunisia to sign the loan. Additionally, the big three international credit rating agencies have cited the lack of an IMF loan as the main factor behind their downgrading of Tunisia's sovereign bond ratings in recent months, and the resulting poor credit ratings have hampered imports for basic and vitally needed goods like wheat in Tunisia. Would that change Tunisian president's position?
No. Both the United States and the European Union have been clear for over a year the IMF deal is really the only way out of Tunisia's economic crisis, and that they are not willing to fund Tunisia until that deal is signed. And the Arab states also have said that they will support Tunisia, but only after an IMF deal is reached. So I think Saeed has really known for quite some time how crucial this deal is. Nevertheless, he does continue to adopt policies related to the IMF and elsewhere that run counter to both Tunisia's needs and to his own political future.
Following the president's speech, Tunisia's Minister of Economy and Planning, Samir Saeed, and the governor of the CPT, Marwan Abbasi, were in Washington heading an official delegation during the World Bank and IMF spring meetings. This signaled that Saeed's rhetoric against IMF wasn't necessarily definitive, with some speculating that he was merely using strong language to press for better terms from an IMF loan, while others questioned whether the president's anti-IMF policy preference was being undermined by his own officials. What's your take on that?
This really shows just how dysfunctional the Tunisian government is right now, with Saeed making public statements that actively undermine the efforts of his own government. I think both Samir Saeed and Marwan Abbasi understand how important the IMF deal is for Tunisia, and they're really just kind of plowing ahead despite Kais Saied's inflammatory rhetoric. But I honestly don't think that Kais Saied is savvy enough to make this statement as a way to get better terms on the IMF deal. Instead, I think it's really just the latest example of him trying to shift the blame for Tunisia's woes away from him and onto someone else. And unfortunately, this represents just the latest example of him taking actions that are not well thought out and that really have the potential to hurt the Tunisian people.
Is he relying on financing from the Gulf countries, for example?
I think he hopes for financing from the Gulf countries, but the Gulf countries have been clear alongside Europe and the United States that they are not going to support Tunisia until an IMF deal is signed. There's no one so far that has said that they are willing to fund Tunisia before an IMF deal is signed. So he's really in a difficult position.
That was Sarah Yerkes, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Middle East Program, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Al Santos, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM.